There's several low-carbon fuel markets out there. Most notably is CARB, the California Air Resource Board, where they made that legislation out there in 2007. And that provides really the biggest market for anything in biofuels right now. British Columbia, European Union, United Kingdom, under consideration, Oregon, Washington State, and 11 Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states are also talking about a low-carbon fuel standard. ESA and the RFS required that all biofuels are evaluated for the greenhouse gas emissions. And as we all know, that based on that category you're put in, you can get some RIN value out of that. And RINs, and they signify a market value, so it's a requirement. New ethanol production must meet greenhouse gas emission reduction standards with the EPA to qualify for a RIN. So it's important that anything new that you do at your plant also comes with lower energy use or lower greenhouse gas emissions. Most of my talk now will be about the CARB market. It's administered by the California Resource Board, and it provides for a scheduled reduction of greenhouse gases for their transportation fuels of 10% by 2020. They've established a carbon trading market, and it incentivizes greenhouse gas reductions for fuel production. LCFS carbon credits have traded for 20 to 85 over the last few years, and last year they averaged about $55 a ton of CO2. They determine in California the life cycle of the biofuels that they use in their transportation sector using the GREET model, which was developed by the Argonne National Energy Lab and Dr. Michael Wong. And that calculates a full life cycle for all energy used in the fuel production cycle. And it's reported in grams CO2 equivalent per megajoule of energy. And people mostly just call that carbon intensity. So CI is kind of the number for anything used in the California market. I think it's really important that we get to continue to work with Argonne Labs and the EPA to get the life cycle, the greenhouse gases accounting done correctly. And for a number of reasons, economic for low carbon fuel standards, if you have an ethanol plant that's better than somebody else down the road, you can get more carbon credits if you sell into the California market. The politics of greenhouse gases now, are growing. You see more talk about reduced carbon intensity. So those greenhouse gas emission markets are likely to grow in that regard, too. And I think new data and new science, most of these life cycles analysis was done probably 5 or 6 years ago, at least now. And lots of things have happened to prove that lots of biofuels have reduced greenhouse gases emissions just based on new production practices, more energy efficient stuff done at the ethanol plants, better efficiency of conversions at the ethanol plants. And the trend is our friend. Fossil fuel carbon intensity is going up, clearly. More remote, deeper, hydrofracking is energy intensive, whereas biofuels are getting better all the time. There's new science, higher yields, all these things that go with it. This is the LCFS schedule. The blue bars represent the average carbon intensity of the fuels that they use going out to 2020. This is in law. As you can see, it's a 10% reduction. It started out at 99.2. That's what gasoline petrol is. And goes down to 89 in 2020. Now, if we just use ethanol, corn ethanol, or any ethanol to blend there, the red bars represent the CI of that biofuel. If we blend it at 10%, that's the required CI to reduce that in their market enough for them to meet the standard. As you can see, it's impossible. I think they've really overdone that, so I think they're going to be really pretty amenable to accepting new pathways that show a lower carbon intensity of their fuels, because they really need low carbon fuels, biofuels in particular, to meet the schedule of their standards. And this is what their slate of biofuels, this is how California looks at all the biofuels or transportation fuels in their sector to meet this schedule. Starting on the left, that's CARBOB. That's 99.2. That's petroleum gasoline. Midwest average dry mill, dry DGS, and natural gas fire, 98.4. That's Midwest average right now, but determined in 2007, so very much old data. Midwest average dry mill wet DDGS, 90.1. Midwest average dry mill dry DDGS coal, pretty high, 125. Brazilian sugarcane average process, 73. Different sorts of processes, 64 or 66, 58. Compressed natural gas, 67.7. Compressed landfill gas, very low, 11.3. Compressed dairy digester biogas, 13.2. Liquefied natural gas, 83.1. California average electrical mix, 124. Compressed hydrogen from natural gas, 142. You know, a lot of talk about hydrogen was going to be the new low-carbon fuel. Well, not from natural gas, it's not. Ultra-low sulfur diesel from average crude, 98. Biodiesel from Midwest soybeans, 83.3. And Midwest dry mill corn oil from distillers grains, a 4. Now, we think this is probably in error. They consider corn oil a waste product, so it doesn't carry in any of the greenhouse gas emissions it took to produce that corn oil in the field. So, and this has provided an opportunity for folks that are putting on biodiesel plants. They can get a very low carbon score in the California market and cash in with some credits. Last year, this is where they got their biofuels, or the types of biofuels they used to meet their standard. Ethanol, corn, and sugarcane, 62%, biodiesel, 27%, and natural gas, 9%. This is what the LCFS carbon credit markets look like over the last, I guess, 15 months. You can see a lot of yo-yo up and down, and it's kind of based on some of the things that's happened politically out there. As you know, there was a lawsuit filed to stop the LCFS by Poet and RFA and others, and the district judge first ruled that they must readopt their LCFS and go back and fix what they kind of skimmed over to begin with when they rolled it out pretty quick. This caused a little market gyration and caused people to pause. Then CARB said readoption may take more than 1 year, made that statement back in, I guess it'd be last fall, and it really caused the market to plunge. They knew that the district judge also said that you have to freeze your schedule until the readoption's done. So they realized, well, they're not going to need as much low-carbon fuel now, so carbon prices went down. And then CARB came out March, I believe, and said this is going to take 2 years. So down it went again. Now, since that time, the U.S. Supreme Court, or it was moved up to the U.S. Supreme Court. People asked them to judge on this, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, we're not going to look at this. It's kind of outside our jurisdiction, so more confidence now that the LCFS will survive. Economic incentives for CI reduction. LCFS credits averaged $55 last year. At $50 per ton, each CI, each gram per megajoule, below 90 means approximately 0.4 cents per gallon ethanol at an ethanol plant. So each 1,000 BTUs in reduction of natural gas use at your ethanol plant is worth about a gram. And ethanol with an 80 CI that can be shipped to California could earn carbon credits for about 4 cents per gallon. This adds up pretty good. And there's a lot of ethanol plants that are down at 80 now. Okay, this is how the GREET model and the model that's used by California, how they determine, this is the complete slate of measurements that they use to determine the life cycle of corn ethanol, greenhouse gas emissions. You can see on the left, ethanol manufacturing, the natural gas use is the big kind of gray bar over there, 35 CI. Then you got electricity is 4 CI, ethanol transportation is 2.9. And we got a big one in fertilizer N2O. This is corn production, greenhouse gas emissions, this next category. If you lose very tiny amounts of nitrogen from your corn fields, from nitrogen applications. It has a huge effect on greenhouse gas emissions because nitrous oxides has their global warming effect of nitrous oxides is 298 times of CO2. So very small losses amount to very large greenhouse gas emissions. They also calculate the nitrogen in the biomass, and they penalize or account for those greenhouse gases emissions coming from land and biomass. Then we've got nitrogen manufacture. We've got diesel gas and propane. We've got lime. We've got urea. We've got corn transportation, herbicides, phosphorus, potassium, insecticides. And then we got a co-product credit. The GREET model assumes that 1 pound of distiller's grain will displace one pound of corn in the life cycle. So we back that out of the equation in the end. And then, of course, the infamous ILUC that the Argonne folks and the EPA tack on to the life cycle of corn ethanol, and that's 30 grams. So in total, we got 98 grams, just about what petroleum gasoline has. But this is 2007 and 2008 when this was done. Lots of newest science since. Here's some of the assumptions, and I'll go through this really quick. They assume for Midwest average corn that the thermal energy is 32,300 BTUs per gallon. Electrical energy is a little over a kilowatt, and ethanol conversion is 2.72. And then the corn production part, nitrogen, they assume 420 grams per bushel, which is equivalent to 146 pounds per acre at 158 bushels an acre. PTO 5, 52 pounds per acre. K2O, 61. Lime, average of 418 pounds per acre. Diesel gas and propane, they assume that the 15 gallons equivalent of diesel fuel is used to do all the farm, you know, the tillage and the harvesting and everything else that goes with that. Herbicides, pretty small there, 2.82 pounds per acre. For the farmers in the room, you can kind of compare your notes to that. This is about what you guys use. You know, I think they did a fairly good job on this. One of the assumptions that we contend is a little bit off is the soil emissions from fertilizer and lime. They assume that the nitrous oxide emissions from nitrogen applications is 1.3 about percent of the nitrogen is lost as N2O. And then there's some CO2 emissions from lime decay, calcium carbonate decay. The co-product credit, we talked about that a little bit. They'd assume 1 pound of distillers displace 1 pound of corn. I don't think that's right. You know, Argonne Labs, in their first life cycle work, said it should be about 1.4 displacement ratio. For some reason, GREET decided to just use one. I think they showed their natural bias against corn ethanol, and CARB especially. Indirect land use change. Now, recently CARB proposed to reduce ILUC for corn ethanol down to 23 grams. So that'd be a nice improvement. And Argonne, this isn't really very recently, but they did a forward look and made the projection that the ILUC for corn ethanol will be 9.1 grams by 2015. Okay, every ethanol plant has the opportunity to reduce the carbon intensity or to prove that their ethanol has lower carbon intensity than Midwest average. CARB provides for that opportunity. There's been about 65 ethanol companies with many more plants. Over 100 plants have applied for that. And the average of that is 86, so considerably lower than the Midwest average that originally Argonne Labs came up with. There's a low of C. 25 plants are below 80. They're cashing in some nice credits now as they ship to the California market. And to date, almost all CI reductions are for reductions in thermal and electrical energy use at the plants, a few for waste, feedstock, landfill biogas, and hydroelectric power, but very few. And three ethanol companies have received reductions in CI for no lime, herbicides, and natural gas use to produce grain sorghum. This is just a visual of the average of all the plants now that have applied. CARB has also realized that we're going to have this problem coming up by maybe 2017 and 2018, where they really need a lot more low-carbon fuel. So they've started this work group that looks at corn production CI, and will allow for a mechanism for each ethanol plant to say, poll its or document its corn production CI. And they're currently developing that verification process. So Dakota Ethanol is right in the middle of doing some of that, a new pathway that involves low CI corn. And they've kind of put it on hold now because of the readoption process, but I think it'll get fired back up starting in about 2016. So I modeled Dakota Ethanol here, what we think our new pathway will look like. And it's kind of based on this, less natural gas and electrical consumption. We're making some nice changes in how much electricity and natural gas we're going to consume, more efficient stuff. Reduce N2O emissions from N and fertilizer, kind of based on low rainfall. Got good data that says that. And maybe using some nitrification inhibitors or enhanced fertilizer efficiency products that reduce the nitrous oxide emissions. Little or no lime application in South Dakota. I would suspect that's also true for Minnesota and probably western Iowa. That'll knock a nice reduction off. And a soil carbon sequestration credit for high-yield corn production and reduced tillage. And once again, ILUC may be reduced by CARB. So this is what the new one will look like. And if you remember, it was 98 before. This one is 98. That's almost a 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions based on new science, better production practices, more efficient energy processes at the plant. You can see, I won't go through them step by step, but big reductions in the nitrous oxide emissions. No lime. Took that one out there. We put on a soil carbon credit worth 21 grams. It's a huge number. You can change, if your fields are growing in soil organic matter, it doesn't take much every year to make a huge difference in the life cycle. And put the ILUC down a little bit and so on and so forth. This is the old one, 98 grams. That's Midwest average. And that's what we're hoping for. Okay, nitrous oxide emissions. I mentioned that they're very powerful greenhouse gases. GREET and Argonne Labs did a literature review to determine what number we should use for this nitrogen to nitrous oxide conversion rate. And I said they came up with 1.325. And they got that from 31 studies that had 79 measurements across the Corn Belt. At Dakota Ethanol, we decided, well, let's look at those closely. You know, all agronomists say that in the western parts of the Corn Belt, we just don't have that problem holding on to our nitrogen because we don't get as much rainfall. And if you know, the eastern part of the Corn Belt, excessive rainfall, lots of denitrification, and lots of losses. So it should be different. And by the way, 70% of the ethanol is made in the western Corn Belt or west of the Mississippi River as so defined. So we looked at those and sorted those by annual precipitation and the use of nitrous oxide inhibitors or nitrification inhibitors or enhanced efficiency fertilizer products. Over to the left, you start out, that's what the average of all that data from those 31 studies, about 1.2, and they came up with 1.325, just a matter of a little different calculation, I think. And then we looked at the average, came up with a number for the average precipitation and conversion rate in corn fields. They weren't all in corn fields. We thought it was only fair that they, since this is a corn life cycle, it should be just done in corn fields. And that got reduced to 0.96. And then we looked at the fields east of the Mississippi River, and they were a lot higher, much, much higher from those studies, almost double of the average. And then we looked at the ones at west of Mississippi River, and obviously half. And when we looked at the ones that are west of the Mississippi River and were not using nitrification inhibitors, 75, and the ones that use nitrification inhibitors and are west of the Corn Belt, very, very low. Big, big reductions in nitrous oxide emissions and a big, big reduction in greenhouse gas emissions for corn ethanol based on the region where you're in. Nitrogen fertilizer efficiency, it's clear. You know, tons of data out there that we're getting better all over the Corn Belt. Organic, we talked about soil carbon. I talked about a soil carbon credit for our pathway at Dakota Ethanol. We work closely with both South Dakota State University and two major Midwest labs that do all the soil testing for our area, or the vast majority of soil testing. The biggest one was Midwest Labs in Omaha, Nebraska, and they had tons of data going back to 1997. And they provided that data, and we built this chart of the trend in soil organic matter. Now, this is across all production practices, across all fields, whether it was corn or soybeans, and came up with this really nice trend. So we should be getting credit for that. And by the way, this trend represents about 380 pounds of carbon per acre per year being sequestered. And that's how I arrived at that number of 21 gram credit for our life cycle, which reduce our greenhouse gas emissions for our entire life cycle about 20%. So big number. Another, a couple of, this is really much, very much field data that was on that previous slide. This is a pretty prestigious soil carbon model that the USDA NRCS uses. It's called the Russell 2. And this is the effect of crop, tillage, historical yields on soil organic matter in Lake County, South Dakota, as predicted by the NRCS Russell 2 model. And they'd call that particular part of the model the soil conditioning index. And we went back and charted it over decades, back really till 1924, where the USDA started taking statistics for yield. And if you're above zero, you see on the left side there's a scale. If you're above zero, USDA predicts, or the Russell 2 predicts, that you're going to be sequestering soil carbon. And you can see for decades there, if you were especially using corn, or using the plow and the disc and the chisel, or plowing the disc and cultivation like we did for decades and decades, it's no wonder we lost all kinds of soil carbon. We were just stirring like crazy, and not only that, the yields were very low. But as the decades go by, as we became better stewards of the soil, and especially how the yields grew, lots more carbon in the residue going back to the soil, bigger root systems, we started, at least NRCS predicted, that we're gaining soil carbon. So you can see, and I threw it up here maybe just to show the contrast between corn and soybeans. Soybeans, even best management practices, it's really hard to grow soil carbon. So back to that chart that shows the average of all practices and all crops across the Midwest, that would be much magnified if they just checked soil carbon in cornfields. Very clear. The other really prestigious soil carbon model, and you guys have probably maybe have heard of this, is called the Century, developed by Colorado State University. It's been around for years and years and years. And recently, some folks over at Argonne, or affiliated with Argonne, wrote a paper in Kwan Wai et al. 2013. And this is what they determined in the various states for soil carbon sequestration. And it shows in metric tons of carbon per hectare per year how much sequestration is going on. So very good support for what we found. Recently, the AIRS in Nebraska completed a study. This is about 2 years ago, and they compared no-till corn and switchgrass over 10 years for its effect on soil carbon. And I'll go through here kind of quick, but it was set up by some switchgrass scientists. They wanted to see how much more soil carbon switchgrass would sequester than corn. Well, needless to say, they were pretty surprised what happened. Corn actually was as much or a little more than switchgrass over 9 years. And they came up with this is one of the first studies that ever measured full soil profile, soil change in carbon in the full soil profile. So it, big numbers, resulted in an average annual increase in soil carbon that exceeded 0.9 tons per acre of carbon, which converts to 3.25 tons per acre of CO2, and at today's LCFS carbon price, it's $137 an acre. So big numbers. More in the red. Our work suggests that carbon sequestration rates used in current life cycle analysis models, like GREET and used at the EPA, for bioenergy crops are probably resulting in underestimates of how much carbon is being sequestered in the soil. But even though its results are no surprising, two other ARS Nebraska studies found similar dynamics. So science is on our side. We just need to get the modelers up to speed with this stuff, I think. Recently, I don't know if you folks seen this or not, but the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and Goddard Space Flight Center had this really nice article about the photosynthesis glow around the world. And they determined that the glow from photosynthesis, the brighter the glow, the more photosynthesis is going on, is higher in the Corn Belt than anywhere in the world, which includes the rainforests in Brazil, the tropical, everywhere else. So for this, for the months that corn is growing fast, which includes right now, obviously, we're capturing more carbon through photosynthesis than any other crop in the world. And I laid that map of corn production side by side to kind of determine that. I just think what that glow would be if it was all corn and not half soybeans. Make a huge difference, because corn being a C4 plant is far more efficient at photosynthesis than a C3 like soybeans. I just threw that in there. This is a current ILUC stuff that CARB publishes. You can see all the studies that have determined ILUC. You look at Sersinger back in 2008, the one that did tremendous damage to our industry, 104 for ILUC, and then various ones. And then over here, CARB 2009, CARB 2009, 30, and now its most recent one that predicts 23. So summarize, expanding low-carbon fuel markets offer opportunities for ethanol and biodiesel producers and corn producers. Incentives can be very large, 5 to 15 cents per gallon ethanol and 25 to 50 cents for corn oil. The trend is our friend. Science says that biofuels are getting better and petroleum gasoline is getting worse. I think biofuels producers should embrace low-carbon fuel market legislation, and we'll be better off for it. Thank you. I'm going to introduce the next person on my panel, and this will be Ray Baker from Adkins Energy. He's the CEO, GM over there, and Adkins Energy is in northwest or northeast.